Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to
Inside the Hive.
I am your host, Nick Bilton, and
Emily Jane Fox.
Emily Jane Fox is in the house!
Can't get rid of me.
I cannot get rid of you. You're actually here in Los Angeles live. You know who's here today?
Who?
Pete Buttigieg. He's not coming on the show, but he's in LA.
You just teased everybody.
I totally just... We do have two guests on the show this week. One is the wonderful, brilliant, unbelievably talented Emily Jane Fox. And then we also have another incredibly talented person, D.A. Wallach, who will be joining me after Emily. He is actually coming on the show to argue with me about everything I talk about on here. So it's actually quite a fun conversation. We're going to talk about consumerism, capitalism, technology, why we're here on this planet, which is my favorite topic, of course. And I think we may have answered it today, so stick around. But first, Mueller. I know, I just like doing the...
I was going to ask you to rank your two guests, but then I just heard your description of your other conversation, and I don't want to know the answer anymore. Sounds like a very good podcast.
It's going to be a great podcast. You should listen. After you leave...
What do you think I'm going to do the rest of
my day? Stick around
and
listen on the slow channel. How, you know when people speed podcasts up? You should slow it down and just be there in the moment.
I'm all about being inefficient.
Okay. Inefficient. All right, so... Emily's going to talk to us for a few minutes here about the news this week, because I have a lot of questions about it. So Mueller yesterday on Capitol Hill, total just like it was like a birthday party that no one showed up to.
Here's what I will say.
Okay.
And I'm annoyed at your characterization and I'm annoyed at everybody's characterization.
Great.
At what happened yesterday.
Love annoying.
Everything about it is annoying to me. So everyone went into this expecting this to be this big television moment, an exciting, dramatic reading of a very boring yet very important 440-something page report. Everyone thought Mueller was going to come in and be this white knight who saved us from this terrible nightmare.
Dun.
It was not exciting television.
No.
I don't care if it was exciting television. That is our Trumpified view of the world, that we need everything to be this television Super Bowl moment where everyone's jaws on the floor, like a Comey testimony, for example, where he dropped all these bombs and everyone thought, this is great TV. This is, we don't live in a reality show. This is real life. This is
we
democracy.
We do live in a reality
we
show.
We don't need to live in a reality show. These are our own preconceived notions
it's
about
true.
What we need for people to pay attention. Yesterday was spectacular, if spectacularly boring, but it was spectacular because we got a couple of really important things out of Mueller yesterday. Now,
he may have
delivered them in a very boring, kind of dopey way.
Hence my Mueller.
Sure, exactly. There,
Mueller,
I get it now.
I support it. Okay.
So he said in plain English that he did not exonerate the president, which is something that the president has been saying on repeat since the report came out.
Yes, but he also didn't say, like, the guy's fucking guilty. We should put him in the slammer. But he could have said that.
He did say that the president can be prosecuted once he leaves office, which was another spectacular thing to hear him say.
Good point.
He said it was basically disgraceful what the president did in encouraging WikiLeaks to hack people's emails. And I thought he confirmed all of the withering things that were in that 448-page report. Now, he didn't do it in dramatic fashion. He wouldn't take the Democrats' bait where they were trying to get him to read some of the juicier moments of that report so they could have that soundbite. But where I think Bob Mueller failed to be this white knight saving us from our Trumpian nightmare, what he did prove was that Trump's the bad guy. Right? So Bob Mueller may not have been the hero, but he very clearly articulated how Trump's the villain.
Do you think that he is, I mean, he has more power to sway public opinion than probably anyone.
I disagree.
You don't think so?
No, because the people who have been listening to Trump for the last 2 years will always see him as a partisan hack who leads the 18 angry Democrats. The people who saw Bob Mueller as a saint listened to him perhaps substantively, were maybe a little bit disappointed that he didn't ride in on that horse and save everybody. So I don't think he has the power to change anybody. Everyone's minds are already locked. What I think is really important, I really hope that Democrats do for the next however many months until the election.
If you're listening,
please listen. And hi. I think that I want there to be a steady drumbeat on Capitol Hill every single week where there is a witness who is testifying to the ways in which the president has broke the law, shattered norms, participated in criminal activity, gone against the emoluments clause in the Constitution. Bring up every way in which he is a crook, he is a criminal, in which he is going against the norms, going against democracy as we know it. And if you have that steady drumbeat, it doesn't have to be the most dramatic hearing, but it keeps in the consciousness all the things that Bob Mueller reminded us of yesterday.
But so let me ask you a question. Isn't there nothing left to drum now that we've had him up at Capitol Hill?
I mean, it doesn't have to be new.
Got it.
Just keep it in the consciousness.
And so, okay, so last question on this topic, because I have a couple of other things I want to get to in our brief time together here. Do you think that this will lead to any more, any inkling of impeachment hearings?
I think that had it been that dramatic moment where it was new information, spectacularly told, and started to feel like it convinced more of the American public that this was real and an imminent danger, you would have heard maybe Pelosi change her rhetoric. I think that this fed into the way that Democrats on Capitol Hill already see the president. I don't think this made it any more urgent or imminent. And so I don't think that this gets us closer to impeachment. I think this keeps us on the steady, slow track that we've been on.
Okay. And so do you think that if you kind of have to predict, and I know we're making this stuff up as we're going mm-hmm. along here, quite literally, do you think that you will see something happen with that steady drumbeat that will lead Pelosi to finally be like, you know what? Let's bring the impeachment hearings.
Probably not.
You don't think it's going to happen?
No, I mean, I think we know what we're going to know about Trump and Russia and obstruction. I think that if we were going to have a fast-paced, quick-moving, swift impeachment process, it would have happened by now. I think you'll continue to hear witnesses called on Capitol Hill. At this point, I think it would have been an important step just so people knew that they couldn't get away with this to perhaps impeach the president, especially over the obstruction stuff. At this point, the hearings are going to go past 2020, so I think attention may be better spent on bringing witnesses, continually keeping this in the American consciousness, focusing on the economy and the ways in which the president is failing the people that he thought, who he tried to sell his economic vision to, and just reminding the people that he is a crook, a criminal, someone who tried to obstruct justice and isn't even helping your pocketbook while he's doing all of that.
It's true. Well, that's a good campaign line that we will play on repeat.
Hire
now.
Hire me.
All right, so next question I have for you. You were at the trial for Epstein?
The arraignment hearing.
The arraignment. Yeah. Tell us what that was like.
Oof.
So give us, just also this week, Jeffrey Epstein tried to commit suicide in jail, so there's that.
I do not want that to be how this ends.
Yes.
For a million reasons.
I'm sure there's a lot of people that do not want this to be how this
Justice
ends.
Justice should be served. Okay, so I love a courtroom. I love reporting from court. It's my favorite thing to do as a reporter.
Why?
Have you ever reported from court before?
I have reported from court.
Do you not love it?
I do love it. The problem, the thing I don't like about it is that they take your phone and you're kind of at the whim of the court officers. And also the food in the courthouse is not that great.
Who has time for the food? Let go, let God. Like, you have no phone. You have no ability to know what time it is. You have no ability to know when things start. You don't know if you're going to get in the room. I love it for a couple of reasons. One of them is it's very competitive. And I'm very competitive. So you have to get there super early. You have to give them your phone. You have to wait in line. There are a million reporters waiting to get in the room. And I feed off of that competitive energy. So I got there really early. I think I was the 10th person there.
You, of course, don't love the food, but keep going, keep going.
Yeah, I don't think I've even ever seen food in the courthouse because I'm really very bad. Focused. So, okay, so I love a courthouse scene. I got in the room. I was in the second row.
Mm-hmm.
And...
have you met him before? Have you seen him before?
No, I've never seen him in person before. This is what I will say. When he walked in the courtroom, I have never in my life felt such evil energy.
Oh, really?
Now, I don't know if it's because I know what he's alleged of doing or if he just has really evil energy about him. I've only felt that with one person. I'll tell you off the podcast who that was because it's someone who's in the current
Donald
news environment.
Trump.
No.
Well, the thing that's like, I haven't met him. I don't think I've met him at least. But when you hear the stories about like the island and the young girls, like you've got to be a really evil, fucked up person to do that.
Just wait.
Okay.
So the hearing is fascinating for a number of reasons. So one of the reasons I found interesting was you have, this is the way the courtroom set up. You have the judge at the front of the room, and then you have the prosecutors, the defense, and then the general public, right? So here is the line. You have Maureen Comey, who's a prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. If that name sounds familiar, it's because she's James Comey's daughter. So you have Maureen Comey. Directly behind Maureen Comey is Epstein. Directly behind him is Jeffrey Berman, who is the head of the SDNY, a Trump appointee, but a well-known man. And directly behind him, you have David Boies, who is the famed, infamous attorney who's been going up against Epstein, representing women who have alleged that they were, as children, abused by Jeffrey Epstein. So it was just quite a straight line of people, straight back. So at the end of this very long hearing in which Epstein's attorneys were trying to argue that he should be given bail. But by bail, I mean he would be essentially creating a private prison in his mansion.
Yep.
And the reason, the justifications were insane. The logic was, we'll create this private prison in his mansion. And the prosecutors were like, if you need to create a private prison in order to ensure that the community is safe, he should be in prison, which is a pretty good argument. Then his attorney said, well, Madoff was given bail and he didn't flee. So using Madoff as an example,
it's like,
or comparing your client to Madoff, maybe the first time it's ever been used in a court of law, not a great way to do it. Anyway, he was denied bail, but these two women who alleged that they were abused as children, when one was 14, one was 16, they said that Epstein had sex with them. They got up, and what I thought was one of the most chilling things I've ever seen was he just stared at them. Epstein just stared at the women as they talked about why they felt he would be a danger to society if he were released. Now, they couldn't see him because they were slightly in front of him, but he just stared at them, and I'd never seen anything like that in court.
Wow.
Usually when people are testifying against you or speaking against you, like the defense looks straight ahead or at their fingers or something.
But he just looked at them.
He just looked at them, and it made me feel like this is evil.
Do you think that you think he'll ever get out, or you think he'll just rot in jail forever? I mean, that's the hope, right?
I don't see how you get out of this.
Even with
I hope
all
he doesn't
the
get
money in the world, which he has.
It's post-money at this point.
That's good.
I think obviously what we saw 10 years ago
was
money.
Unbelievable that he pulled that off.
It's despicable and it's disgusting. I think we're post-money at this point. I think the money almost makes it more likely that justice will be served here because it was so wrong what happened a decade ago.
All right. So two last things that I want to get to. One is Michael Cohen, your best friend. How's he doing?
My best friend. Michael is in prison and he was watching the Mueller hearings yesterday. Hang on, I'm pulling up the statement that he sent me from federal prison.
He texted you?
He texted me a statement from prison yesterday.
Oh, very exciting.
His name was invoked a million times yesterday in the hearing because Congress people were asking Mueller about the ways in which Trump potentially obstructed justice and witness tampering, and a lot of the things that he testified to about the Trump Moscow project, et cetera, et cetera. So the statement was, Quote, Mueller today had the world stage to answer questions regarding obstruction of justice and witness tampering. Sadly, his reluctance just continues to leave the debate open and those responsible free from prosecution for the moment. The American people deserve more.
Is he referencing Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think that the search warrant application was unredacted and released to the public, I think, last week. And it revealed that, obviously, the president had directed him to make those payments to women who had alleged affairs with him, that he had spoken about it over text message with Hope Hicks, and that Hope Hicks had called him before and after these payments and after the Access Hollywood tape was released. Hope Hicks had testified under oath that she didn't know about these payments ahead of time. These text messages make it very hard to understand how she could have made that statement under oath.
So here's the question. So Cohen's in jail, right?
For 3 years.
And
no one else is getting in trouble. They closed the investigation.
That's a little fucked up, honestly. I'm sorry for all the cursing today. I'm a little angry.
Sorry, Mom.
It is
wild. Look, Michael Cohen broke the law.
So did Hope Hicks.
He pleaded guilty.
So did Donald J. Trump Jr. And
the president.
Yes.
Right? The president, the prosecutors have stated unequivocally that this was at the direction of President Trump. Michael Cohen committed some of the crimes that he pleaded guilty to, not all of them, but some of them, at the direction of the president, that Hope Hicks knew about this, that Don Jr. signed the checks to reimburse Cohen for these, that no one else is being held accountable is one of the most incomprehensible things. I don't know. I have not been able to get a straight answer. Cohen doesn't really have an answer. It makes no sense to me. I understand that if you're not going to charge the president, obviously we heard a million times yesterday from Mueller that you don't charge a sitting president, right? But there are a lot of other people. Why was Alan Weisselberg, the longtime Trump org CFO, given immunity to go after Cohen? Cohen's not the big fish there. Weisselberg is the big fish. Cohen's the guppy in the pond.
So do you think that there's a world in which after Trump is out of office in 2056 that that was a joke.
Was it?
Oh God, hopefully. After he's out of office eventually, whenever that happens, that he is prosecuted?
It depends on the statute of limitations.
Okay.
So I don't know what the statute is on campaign finance crimes. Look, a lot of people don't get prosecuted for campaign finance crimes. They just pay a fine. Right? That Cohen's going to prison in part because of that is unusual.
Is there a world where Don Jr. or Hope Hicks...
No, they closed the investigation.
But can't they reopen it because they lied? Or it's done?
I think it's done. I mean, Congress could do something to Hope for lying. But Congress's response last week is baffling to me. And it's sort of sexist and sort of incomprehensible to me. They gave her the chance to reword her testimony.
Why?
Because it's very clear that she lied under oath.
But why give her the chance?
Because they have been treating her like a damsel in distress. This is someone who is a 30-year-old woman who was head of the communications at the White House, who now is running communications for a major public company. But, oh, Hopi is...
It makes me so angry.
It's honestly offensive. It's funny to me. The Senate Judiciary Committee, after Cohen's testimony to Congress in February... subpoenaed documents from about 70 people, including Jared Kushner, both Trump sons, Trump Organization, Tom Barrack, a million bajillion people, right? Ivanka Trump was not on that list. Now, Congress members said, we didn't need her and maybe she'll come down the road. And some of the chatter was it would anger Trump too much to have her on that list.
What?
But it is just so sexist to me that the two people who are treated with kid gloves are Ivanka Trump and Hope Hicks, like these pretty women.
Okay, so you said before, and I've always wondered how this would play out, but the Me Too movement has helped bring down a lot of very, very, very bad men.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought, oh, well, there is going to be some sort of repercussion on the other side that will affect something. I didn't know what it was, whatever. Is part of it maybe that because, you know, you mentioned earlier Epstein got away with 10 years ago what he got away with, that he can't today, and it's because of the world we live in today. Is part of the the negative response to this, that women like Hope and Ivanka that have done terrible things will get away with what they've gotten away with because no one wants to go after a woman in this climate?
No. I think that it's still backwards. This is not a forward-looking thing that they're not going after these women. I think it's still a backwards-looking thing.
What do you mean?
That people aren't treating Ivanka and Hope like equals. They're treating them as these little girls.
Got it.
They're treating them with kid gloves.
So it's exactly the way it was.
Exactly. Hope is such a pretty young woman. Ivanka is such a pretty young woman. And Trump would freak out if you touch one of his pretty young women. So we're not going to poke the bear by going after one of his girls. But really, these are very capable women who hold very senior roles in the most senior portion of our government. But we can't go after them. Let's let them amend their testimony. We're not going to subpoena Ivanka.
That's so much.
We got a brother and our husbands. We don't need to anger Trump by getting her.
All right. So last question, and then we'll let you go, and I'll go drink a glass of whiskey at 9 a.m. in the morning.
Appropriate.
Just kidding. I don't do that. Wait till 10:30.
Like a
civilized human being. So last week, there was a report in the New York Times that they looked at all the data, the polling data and so on and so forth about 2020. And the thing that they came up with was that it looks like, and I'm going to say something after this before I'm going to say this first and then something after. So just to kind of put a little cold water on this, it looks like Trump will probably win, according to the Times research, more votes in, especially in the Electoral College than in 2020 than he did in 2016. I will say, before we kind of run for the hills and move to Canada, that we don't, first of all, we don't know what's going to happen. Anything could change between then and now. And second of all, like the New York Times data people really royally screwed it up in 2016. And so we should take it with a little bit of a little salt on it. But that being said, there is a chance that it's right. And my question for you is, do you think, like right now we're witnessing the Democratic Party, there's a lot of infighting. I think the way Nancy Pelosi has been acting, I personally think is terrible. Like she should be above it all and she should be the one that's bringing it all together rather than going and having lunch with Maureen Dowd and complaining about some young women that are in the party. But it seems like they're all, like everyone's fighting with each other, Kamala and Biden and this person and that person. And like, are they going to screw themselves up and kind of just hand this thing to him?
I think primary infighting is usual. What's going on with this so-called squad is ridiculous. Part of it is a media creation. Part of it is a Trump creation. And then part of it is people just behaving like children. And I think there needs to be one common goal, and there can be disagreements on policy things, which is great. It's healthy. It's democracy. We want that. But the common goal should be uniting to have a Democrat in the White House in 2020. And any other little squirmish that comes up, policy difference, can be handled like adults in a civilized fashion. Otherwise, things are going to devolve into kind of what we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks. I think everyone just needs to take a breath. Thank you for that demonstration. And say, we have bigger matters at hand here.
Do you think they will?
Yeah.
I've been very unimpressed with the way Nancy Pelosi handled this, honestly.
It's funny. I feel like she is such a polarizing people. Half the people I talk to feel like you and probably a lot more negative towards her.
I'm holding myself back
okay,
right now,
so you
honestly
fall into that negative camp. And then half the people are like, she is a master. She is handling this so well. Here's what I think Nancy Pelosi does really well. I think Nancy Pelosi knows how to handle Trump better than anybody. When she handles him, she is a master.
Totally agree with that.
Within her own party is where she struggles.
Yeah, I think that the reality is that you have, we can take the squad, for example, and they are four young women who have all experienced things that, because they are of color, that Nancy Pelosi has never experienced, probably, mm-hmm. definitely, and that they they kind of see the world differently. And I don't think that she gets that. She sees it as like a power thing with the old and the new and this, that, and the other. And what pissed me off the most about the whole debacle was that she chose to go after them publicly the way she did. I just thought that was, I thought it was just wrong. I think it's like, sure, she can disagree with them. She may not like the fact that they're on Twitter and tweeting the things that they do or whatever it is, or saying the things they do or having the viewpoints. But like, you've been doing this long enough that you should. And it, for me, it points to another example of why I cannot, I pray and I hope that Biden isn't the person going up against Trump. Like, let's get rid of these old people that have been doing this for 50 years and have completely fucked it up and put in some young people that have a different viewpoint and are like, hey, you know what? I have an idea. Maybe it's not the right idea, but let's give it a shot.
So Sam Nunberg, you know Sam Nunberg, yep. He worked at the Trump Organization on the campaign. I think he is very smart in how he sees the Trump world. And we talked yesterday after the Mueller hearing, and he said to me, I hope it's okay that I say this, Sam. He said to me, I hope the Democrats saw today that they cannot put Biden up, because he just... Today shows you what it's like to put an old man up against Trump, and it's not going to work.
No, it's not going to work.
And I thought it was an astute point.
Yeah, I think that you, the only, like, I keep going back to Buttigieg and I, you know, and people like Kamala and so on. And I keep thinking Trump knows how to fight with the older people that he's been fighting with for a long time, except for Nancy Pelosi. Mm-hmm. And she's very good at what she does in that respect. He will wipe the floor with a Biden, with a Sanders. He'll win. It's like a boxing match, and he's been he's a better
Harris
boxer.
Out.
I think Harris. I think Warren. I the only thing with Warren is I don't know if she's too far left for the people in the middle.
She's polling in a crazy way.
Yeah, and I totally. And I think Buttigieg, and I think that it's going to come down to those three at the end. I hope that it's two of them that are on the same ticket. And I think that that's the chance that you have to win.
If you make this a torches blazing, income inequality, economic showdown between Warren and Trump, you will have a very interesting election cycle.
Completely. Yep.
There you have it.
Well, with that, so do you actually, I have a question for you. Do you want to know why we're here on this earth and in this universe?
That's all I want to know.
Well, then stick around, because our next guest doesn't have the answer.
I'm here for
but
it.
But I have some answers.
Great.
It's a good show. Thank you so much, EJF, as always.
My pleasure.
All right.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
Ready?
Sure am.
Okay. Do you want to, since this is your podcast this week, would you like to say welcome to Inside the Hive?
Oh, welcome to Inside the Hive.
And you're my...
I'm your host, D.A. Wallach, not Nick Bilton today. I've taken over.
So, D.A. Wallach, who came on the show about a year and a half ago, is a good friend of mine and has a lot of very different viewpoints on a lot of topics that we cover here. And we ended up bumping into each other at... a co-working space, and he what did you say? You said I'm coming on your podcast.
I mean,
don't
degrade it. It's not a co-working space. This is an elitist. this is
all right. Before we get to the elitist, we ended up bumping into each other, and DA said, "You know what? I'm going to come on your podcast and interview you.
That's right.
And prove you wrong."
No, I mean, what I wanted to do today, hopefully, was psychoanalyze you. I mean, I really want to get...
Oh, I didn't realize that's what this
Well,
was.
I just perceive in one of the engines of our conversations as friends being various tensions that exist within your personality and probably within mine as well.
Great.
We're both quite neurotic, you know, approaching middle-aged guys. I think I'm actually
middle-aged.
You're not truly middle-aged. I mean, I would define middle-aged as like, you know, mid-50s.
Is this our first argument?
Mid-50s.
Oh, okay. So I'm like lower middle-aged, 43.
Okay, and I'm 34.
Okay.
So but, like, we're
I could be your father.
We're peaking. We're physically and socially peaking right now.
Yes.
It's all downhill from here. And, you know, in particular, yeah.
Before we go to where you're going to go,
okay,
let's just tell people who you are so they know. So you're D.A. Wallach. Do you want to do it? You want me to do it?
Yeah, I'm D.A. Wallach. I was a professional rock musician for many years. After college, got a record deal, which is what brought me out to California. And after years of living in a bus with eight other men doing rock shows, I retired from music, became a technology investor, and more recently have become a biotechnology-focused investor. But I have a weird LA lifestyle that combines music, intellectual pursuits, and investing in biotech companies.
Okay, great. Now that we've got that out of the way, let's do it. Come on, bring it on.
Well, so the first tension that I want to sort of get at is that on the one hand, you are an incredibly critical person towards...
I thought you were going to say beautiful, but...
Beautiful, yeah, I agree. That's obvious. But you have an acute awareness of the excesses of contemporary society and culture.
Okay.
And yet you yourself, like many of us, are also drawn to consumerism. We've had a lot of conversations that I would regard as aesthetic conversations, but also consumer conversations about the merits of various cars or coffee makers or other objects.
Okay.
And I'm interested in how you see these two forces in your personality.
Oh, wait, the consumerism versus...
The consumerism versus the criticality.
Well, but I'm critical of companies and actions of people... Not necessarily critical of consumerism. I mean, I think that it's interesting. So we all have things that we're interested in. I was at a camera store the other day. I've always been into photography, and I have it. So it was like my passion in high school. I had a Pentax K1000. I remember the first time I stood over the light box and put some jewelry on it, and we, you know, saw the contrast of the black and white on a piece of paper. That was like, it was an amazing moment to me. And I was standing there and I was looking at a lens that I wanted to get for some like night photography I was going to do. Anyway, besides the point. And the guy says to me, he goes, what are your other like hobbies? What are the other things you're interested in? And it was this moment where I was like, oh, it's so fascinating. We all kind of have like three or four things that we like. And for me, you just kind of mentioned them. Like, I like old cars. I like coffee machines and coffee and cameras and things like that. I don't think that makes me someone who cannot be critical of companies or CEOs or something like that if I like those objects.
Well, maybe it's consistent because a lot of your critical work as a journalist or as a commentator is about new technology. And yet, all of these things in some ways are old technologies that you are really drawn to.
Okay, well,
are you drawn to them for the aesthetic of the old technology, or do you think there was something about old technology that was somehow different from new technology that attracts you to it?
Yes. Okay. I will tell you what it is. It's that it's slower. And you know, it's funny, you just sat down in my office and behind me there's some books that I've written and some framed photos and things like that. And you just said, I live in the future and here's how it works. And that was my first book. I wrote it 10 years ago and no one should read it. I will just put that out there. But it was this like glowing look at the future. And it was this prediction that social media was before social media, people were using it, that it was going to have this amazing effect on the world, that driverless cars and virtual reality, all these things were going to be incredible. There's actually chapter two of the book is about the porn industry and how that would be at the forefront of VR, proving to be true. Not that I've ever experienced it. But I think that the reality is that if you look at these old technologies, they were adopted slower. They act slower. They make you think a little bit in a way that new technologies don't. So, and for example, like if you look at the adoption rate of the television, it was 100 years before every home had one. And if you look at the adoption rate of the smartphone, it was a few years. And the adoption rate of like an app like FaceApp or something like that, it's days. It's hours sometimes. It's like, you know, I remember I interviewed Evan Spiegel, who created Snapchat when I was at the New York Times. And he had just that morning, it was like an 11 o'clock interview on stage. And just that morning, they had released a new product. It was a new set of like some filters or something like that. And they hadn't put out an announcement about it. And I said to him, how do you get these things out without putting out an announcement? He said, well, the community sees it to themselves, and that's the beauty of it. That's what makes it fun. And I said, well, what percentage of the community of your 300 million users at the time have used it? And he said, like 90% already. And wow. This was like in a matter of like 2 hours. And I think that that's an example of like, it goes to the big problem with technology that I have today is it all happens so quickly. And when things happen quickly, you break things, and it's not necessarily a good thing. Does that answer the question?
Well, do you think there was something different about the people and the intention behind, a beautiful Porsche from the 70s? Or, I mean, it strikes me that technology businesses, be it a car company or a coffee maker company, always have a alliance between the tinkery nerds who just want to do the art kind of project, or they just want to do the engineering project, and then the money people who got to figure out how do we sell this thing? How do we get people to use it? How do we keep the lights on? And do you perceive that, you know, one or the other has sort of gotten more power? Because if you think about the Zuckerbergs, the Larry Pages, I mean, these are bona fide computer scientists themselves who have ended up in these positions of power.
Well, I think that there's two things to that question. The first is that you mentioned Porsche, right? There are Porsches from the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s that literally have a million miles on them, on their engines, right? And that was because they built these things, which is partially why those old cars are so coveted. They built these things without obsolescence, right? There is no one I know that has an iPhone 1. It is not designed to think about the consumer in the respect of the consumer's best interests. I mean, like, look at, everyone loves Apple. It's a great company. The fact that they charge $40 or $50 for an iPhone case that costs them mere pennies to make, like, and this is one of the richest companies in the world, I think is fucking disgusting, honestly.
Just to push back on that, like, I have a MacBook Pro MacBook Air or whatever. That's 5 years old.
Yep.
I see no reason to get a new one because it feels to me like that tech asymptoted then, or maybe even a couple of years before it. You know, the phones right now, you know, I'm feeling less of an impulse to buy a new one every 2 years when, you know, maybe 5-6 years ago, it was like you were in the dark ages if you didn't upgrade every 2 years, if you could afford to. And so, you know, is it just that we have lived over the past decade through this rapid explosion of innovation in these areas where, you know, the products did evolve very, very rapidly, but maybe now they're kind of going
to plateau.
I
think they are starting to plateau. I think, I mean, you as an investor know this as well as anyone. Like, one of the things I hear from a lot of venture capitalists is that they're having trouble investing in things because they don't know the next thing is not here yet. The technology to create the next thing isn't here yet. You know, driverless cars and genomics and all these different things. And so they're kind of in this no man's land. But I do think that, you know, going back to Apple and Facebook and these companies, like, I think that they truly take advantage of consumers. And I'm not sure, look, I'm not an expert on like the CEO of Porsche in the 1970s, if he did the same thing, or like Mercedes or whatever. I'm sure that there were bad people and there were good people, but I feel like predominantly the people in the tech world who are running it are not thinking about the consumer, first of all, and are not owning up to their screw-ups and massive, massive screw-ups, and that they don't feel like they have a responsibility. And, you know, it's like, it's so interesting. I remember when we had this conversation, when we bumped into each other, and I pulled out my phone and I held it up and I said to you, you know, at the end of the day, when you think about it, like we all spend, you know, you can look at your screen time, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours on your device every single day. And it's like a war to try to not use it as much as you do. But at the end of the day, is our life really that much better because of this device? I took photos before I had this, and I probably took them more carefully and thoughtfully, and the photos probably meant more. I sent people emails, even if before emails, you know, there was other forms of communication. I spoke on the phone. There was instant things with faxes. There's all these things that technologies that had these massive shifts in the universe that we are reliant upon. But I don't necessarily know if the iPhone and smartphones have been that great for society. Do you?
I mean, it's unclear. I mean, there's so many ways to skin that cat. Like, you know, everyone being on all the time, a company being defined today by a group of people that communicate 24/7, I presume is in some measures much more productive. I mean, just the fact that people are working presumably longer hours because they're responding to emails all night until they go to sleep in some ways suggests that. Now, you know, I take the point that if you're just sort of playing Candy Crush to kill time, that's a less enriching activity than what you would have done to kill boredom in the past. But I think it's too soon to say. I mean, the one thing that's clear out of all of it, for putting aside what's happened in our politics as a result of social media and everything, is this teen suicide rate, you know, explosion. Now, it's unclear that there's a single cause, and, you know, easy to say, oh, it's Facebook or something. That may not be true. I mean, a lot is changing all at once, but something has happened in the past decade where a lot more teenagers are killing themselves, and that would seem to reflect some pretty significant wrong turn that we've taken.
So here's my question. Do you believe, let's just say hypothetically, that a report just came out today that said that teenagers are killing themselves because they because of social media in one respect or another, right? Do you think that these companies should have a responsibility to try to figure out how to stop that from happening?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you...
Oh, okay, so we agree.
Cigarette companies did, you know, and I think the fact that their products also do lots of good things is what makes it hard. You know, my 93-year-old father-in-law, who has children who live in multiple countries, goes on Facebook to see what's going on with them. In some ways, this is a guy who, you know, 20 years ago would have been miserably lonely and bored sitting in his house, probably aging faster. And yet, the level of connectivity that he feels to what's going on in the news, to people he knows, to his family, to my life, to my wife's life, is really facilitated by Facebook in particular. And so, you know, it strikes me that these technologies have produced potentially a lot of good and a lot of bad. And the challenge is how do you not throw the baby out with the bathwater? Or maybe we just press pause. And I think, you know, one of the challenges, to go back to the car thing by comparison, like, you know, the Porsche in the 60s or 70s, there almost used to be in product design an aspiration to write the final word on something.
What do you mean?
You know, I'm going to design the best car ever. You know, the Charles and Ray Eames, or however you say it, you know, a couple of years ago when we bought a house, which you heard a lot of my neuroses about, went and sat, I literally sat in hundreds of dining room chairs. One of the negative prices I've paid for tech has been chronic neck pain because I'm at a computer so much. And so I really wanted dining room chairs that I could sit comfortably in for hours having a really good dinner party. And, you know, you're hard pressed to find more comfortable dining room chairs than those that were designed in the 60s. I mean, remarkable to me that with all of our modeling and technology and materials, dining room chair comfort is something that is frozen in time. And similarly, you know, it's hard to find a car that's more beautiful than that old Porsche. Those designers were trying to do the best thing ever, and they wanted to write the final word on that idea. These were like platonic goods that they were creating. And by contrast, you know, the folks who have created these internet products explicitly have a mindset of, you know, move fast and break things. It's never perfect. Put it out there, see what the world does with it. You know, maybe in a certain way, what we're asking for is more paternalism on the part of these designers.
But you, so you once said to me that what's your analogy with it, with buying things, where you said that there's like something in the world and you have to find it. What was the story you told me?
Yeah, my theory was that, you know, you don't need, you shouldn't, unless you're really consumer sick, you shouldn't buy nearly as much stuff as most people do. Certainly as much as I have over time, because, and I know because I've thrown out a lot of it, right? So those were all mistakes in a certain sense. And so my idea, particularly for shopping for clothes, was as a thought experiment, imagine that a number of things have been custom made for you, and then they've been hidden in stores around the world. And so shopping should be like a scavenger hunt for these items that are clearly bespoke to you, not, you know, looking to compromise. You know, you should never buy something unless it's truly everything you've wished for in a pair of pants. Anytime you hedge, you end up regretting it, you throw that out, you know, it goes to Goodwill.
So do you think, so when you look at the world that was frozen in time in the 60s where they really did care about the products, I mean, it's interesting you say that because I love cooking, as you know.
Yeah.
And my favorite cooking utensils and things are things that were designed decades ago. Like the Le Creuset pot that you can make a stew in, or the cast iron pans, things like that. Those are the only things I use. And it feels like all these gadgets that come along, like your sous vide and your this, that, and the other, you use them for like a few weeks and you're like, not really, it doesn't make any sense. And I feel like it goes back to this problem with the speed of which technology is made and adopted, and you know, and I feel like if I could do anything, I would be to press the pause button.
Right, right.
Is that wrong, do you think, or?
Well, I don't know that it's wrong. I mean, the challenge with pressing the pause button is that whatever positive outcomes are being generated in all this innovation would be the casualty, you know? And again, it's like you'd be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. You know, you don't want the teen suicide problem, but you do want people who have been politically disenfranchised to have a voice. And, you know, part of the challenge in the, let's call it left immune response to Trump, is that there's been an inability for people to imagine that maybe this is what democracy in America looks like. You know, maybe what we saw with Trump's election or with the Tea Party is actually a large number of disenfranchised people being given a political voice and doing with that voice something that a number of us find despicable. But almost the preoccupation with Russian hacking or with these sort of conspiratorial explanations is almost a liberal evasion of this other explanation I'm proposing, which is that, you know, democracy is sort of unbiased around outcomes. It's the idea is you let a group of people vote on something, and you have to admit the possibility that they're going to vote for stuff that may be stupid.
No, that's such a really smart point. I think it's like we spend so much time thinking like, oh, this all went wrong, and maybe it went the way it was supposed to go.
Well, or maybe not the way it was supposed to go, but maybe the way that the majority wanted it to go. I mean, by definition, you know, you can point to the Electoral College is broken and there was, you know, disinformation on Facebook and whatever. But I remember one time during the George W. Bush administration, and I was a sophomore in college, and I went on a vacation to the Caribbean in between semesters. And I'm in the line for immigration. And it turned out the island I was going to, Justice Stephen Breyer of the U.S. Supreme Court has been visiting and has a house on, and he's been going there for decades. And I end up in the immigration line next to Justice Breyer. And so I get to talk to this Supreme Court justice. And he said to me, you know, you're a college kid, what's the climate like on your campus? And I said, well, you know, it's the midst of the, I think it was at the time, the 2004 election. And people are just really, this was me, I'm saying, people are so frustrated because George W. Bush lied about the Iraq war and he got us into this war. And, you know, it's just amazing that anyone would vote for him after that misdirection and that sort of fraud against the public and abuse of their trust and the credibility of the office. And he said, you know, actually, this was right after he had been reelected. And this is why I was expressing, I'm so disappointed. Mm-hmm. You know, we were all aghast that he got reelected. And he said, well, you know, to be fair, I think the voters knew what they were choosing here. You know, I don't think you, he was essentially saying to me, I don't think you need to make a claim that they were fooled. It's sufficient to just recognize that they had the information about whether the war was predicated on true or false evidence. They still voted for him again, and they wanted him. And there, it's almost condescending to have to explain away people's, I think, bad decisions as being, you know, grossly misinformed or as if somehow they're infants who don't have agency. Yeah. Like, how about lots of people are capable of making terrible choices, even if they're smart? You know, maybe some of the smartest people are susceptible to making even worse choices.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
So do you think that when you kind of relate that to Trump and the world we live in today, do you think that there is truth and there is not truth, right? And I think I've spent time in the South in the last year or so for some reporting I've been doing, and with a lot of Trump, Trump voters, and what's so fascinating is you watch Fox News, and there is a regurgitation of the things you see on Fox News. So I got back from a trip recently, and I said, you know what, I'm going to watch some of these clips that these folks are talking about to see what it is. And it's clear bullshit. It is just 100% bullshit. It's that Trump is a religious man who loves Jesus and the Bible. It's that he's been a great businessman his entire life. There's just a long list of things, and it's very clever the way they do it. If you watch Fox and Friends in the morning, for example, they'll push back with an answer. They'll be like, "Well, wait a second, da 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 da," and you're like, "You just told him what to say, and you made it seem like you were disagreeing with him." And I guess the question is you know, if you go back to the early days of newspapers, there was a philosophy between these two philosophers who were very instrumental in creating the media world we live in today. And one of them said that the public is essentially stupid for the most part. The majority of people are not that smart, and that it is our job as journalists to tell them what is important and what to think about and what to read about, and to inform them, and not for them to ask questions, but of us to explain it to them. The other point of view was, well, if that's the public, if that's the majority, then they know the things that they want to know about, and they should be telling the journalists what to report, essentially, as a group. And essentially, the former was the one that won out. And what the internet has done is it's kind of changed it to the latter, right? Where it's no longer the editor of a newspaper is deciding what is on the front page every single day. It's being decided by Twitter and social media and forums and YouTube and you name it. And I think both of them are kind of wrong, honestly. And the question I guess I have is, like, Do you think that we have a responsibility to let these people who voted for Bush and Trump and even a bunch of Democrats that I am not fans of, like Biden, to let them know the truth? Or is it that we just have to kind of let it play itself out?
Well, I think what you're getting at is the extent to which capitalism, consumerism, to go back to our earlier conversation, has eaten everything in the society.
Yeah.
And the internet, connectivity, rapid information transfer has just facilitated that capture by capitalism of everything, including obviously journalism and information. And so, you know, capitalism explains all of this. It explains a society in which people consume the news that they are most interested in consuming. And the vast majority of people are interested in consuming news that confirm what they already believe.
How does capitalism explain it?
Well, because the consumer is getting what they want. I mean, I often think capitalism should be called consumerism. I mean, the reason it's called capitalism is because the owners of capital expropriate value in a Marxist construct. But really, the mechanism that drives it, the way I think about investing in businesses, is that the rule in this system is that what consumers want happens.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever's able to give them what they want wins. And, you know, that's sort of all you need to know to understand Jeff Bezos as one example. And he explicitly describes this. I mean, if you ever hear him going back to the beginning of Amazon talk about how they do what they do, it's customer obsession. And I think he really means that. And I don't think he's saying that to sound altruistic in some way. I think he understands how capitalism works, which is if a business is obsessed with its customers and goes to great pains to understand exactly what they want and to super serve them that, those consumers give them money. And that's what dictates cash flows in the economy. So it's no accident the Roger Ailes of the world, who figured this out, made a fortune off of it and built empires around it. And, you know, I think the question is, what countervailing force can resist the excesses that inevitably produces?
So if you're saying that that it's capitalism that is deciding this, which I completely 1,000% agree with, it's very clear to me when I look at someone like Jeff Bezos and how much money he has, that capitalism doesn't work. Jeff Bezos has got the same amount of money as the poorest 40, 50 million people in the United States. The top four richest people in the world have the same amount of money as the bottom 3.6 billion. That to me says that capitalism, consumerism, whatever you want to call it, is broken. Do you, if you know, there's this amazing book I read years ago by Alan Lightman, who's an author I've referenced before on the podcast, but he, it's called Einstein's Dreams. And it's a fictional book about what all these different worlds that Einstein would have dreamt about while he was developing the theory of relativity. And it's time is different in all of them. And so in one world, you, based on how close you are to the Earth, it's as it's spinning, it moves quicker, and you age quicker. The further away you are, it ages slower. So all the rich people live on these really tall stilts on the top of, you know, mountains and so on, and they live hundreds of years, and the poor people die sooner at the bottom by the ground. There's another chapter where there's a spot in the Earth where if you stand there, time stops, and all these couples line up to be able to stand on this spot so that they can kiss and love and blah, 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 blah. So, but the reason I bring this up is because I'm curious, as someone who's thought about this a lot, the whole consumerism aspect of it and technology and capitalism and so on, if you could reconstruct the world in a new way, the society we live in, you know, people have tried it, Marxism and capitalism and blah, blah, blah. Is there a way you think that would work best?
Well, I don't know, obviously.
Yes, I know, but I'm not saying, but hypothetically speaking, like, is there something?
I mean, I think you start by not being imprisoned by a paralyzed vision of any of these ideologies or organizational approaches. Meaning, you know, what capitalism looks like in America today is very different than what it looked like even in America 50 years ago. So, you know, whether you want to come up with a new name for it or just call it, you know, capitalism in 2019, who cares? But these are dynamic sort of operating systems that we're all agreeing to utilize. And what's very clear is that there can be innovation in forms of social organization, just like there can be innovation in any other kind of technology or idea. And what we, at a minimum, should do is always be seeking to fix what doesn't work about it. So, you know, again, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not like the choice is capitalism or socialism.
Has anyone ever actually thrown a baby out with the bathwater, you think?
That's an interesting question. we could try it after the podcast.
I got a couple of babies.
You have a couple babies. But, you know, I think this gets me to another tension in you.
Great.
That I want to dig into a little bit.
Bring it.
Which is, on the one hand, you are obviously drawn to the aesthetic. In at least two ways. You like good industrial design, or at least some kind of industrial design. Your house is very tasteful. I'm sitting in it right now. It's beautifully done. I know you were intimately involved with the remodeling of it. So you care about how things look, how they feel, how they're designed. And you also care about stories.
Oh, yes.
And both the aesthetics and the stories are both touchstones of an artist. And yet, on the other hand, you have been, in various moments, a critical journalist, a pundit. How do you think of these two sides of your personality coexisting? And do you ever find them fighting with each other?
That's a good question. So I actually went to art school. My life began as an artist. I studied painting, and my goal was to be able to paint photorealistically, and I thought it was going to take a lifetime, and it turned out it took about 6 months, and, you know, just being anal and with a little paintbrush, you can do it. And I think that what I find so interesting is that some of the people who, well, to go back to the aesthetics, right? I actually kind of see that as like a curse, that you care about the way things look. It's great because we, you know, it's nice to be able to admire pretty things and well-designed things. And I, you know, this black cup that I'm drinking a cup of coffee out of, but I like envy people that cannot care about those things. But at the same time, like, if you don't care about those things, then you probably won't appreciate them in nature too. And so it's interesting. I was reading a book about symmetry recently, and about how we are such weird creatures that we are drawn to symmetry, but we're also drawn to asymmetry, right? And there's no rhyme or reason to why. People have theorized, maybe you know from some of your research why, but I always find that so fascinating that we like the fact that certain plants and flowers have specific shapes, and then we also like the fact that others are complete dramatic opposites of themselves, and the same with animals and so on, and I think that design and aesthetics and so on is something that kind of it plagues me a little bit, honestly. But to go back to the other part of the question, we're all storytellers, right? I know it's a bullshit thing that like brands say these days, like, I'm a storyteller.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that's the thing that separates us, right? That's why we gather around. That's why people have earbuds in right now listening to us talk. It's because they're listening to a story. And where what I've always tried to do with my stories is to offer kind of a moral lesson that I have been going through at that period of time.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
I want to switch gears a minute here.
Yeah.
So we only have a little bit of time left. And you and I have a different viewpoint on a topic that is actually kind of related to this in some respect, because it all is. So I'm obsessed with, this is the thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately. You know where this is going, don't you?
God.
Not God. Not God.
The mystic force.
But why we're here.
Okay.
And what's been really interesting to me is over the past couple of years, I've had a lot of super duper smart people on this podcast. Way smarter than me, who have done research into, and it's all science related. And the more, you would think that the more I hear from scientists and authors on these topics, that I would eventually be like, oh, like Fox News, right? Oh, I get it. That makes sense. That's the way it is. But the more I've heard from these folks, the more I believe that there is a reason that we're here. And a lot of them say there isn't, and there's just it's just chance. And so the question I have for you, and I can answer, I can explain why in a minute, but the question I have for you is, you don't seem to think it's important if there is a reason or there isn't, right?
More or less.
How?
Well, I would argue that why, in this context, isn't a question that science can answer. You know, to ask why we're here is to ask about meaning, and I would argue that we create meaning. It's not out there to be discovered. And to that extent, any story we tell ourselves and each other about why we're here is a creative act, and that's fine. And I'm not opposed to people creating explanations or narratives that give a sense of purpose and value to their lives. But I am suspicious of the idea that there is a single why that would ever satisfy everyone. And, you know, what is more amenable to science is how did we get here? And, you know, I think when you and your wife were over at our house for dinner with Francis Arnold, who won the Nobel Prize this past year.
Good name drop.
Good name drop. Well, we didn't win the Nobel Prize, but we did convince her to come over for dinner with our friends, the Biltons, as bait. And she said to you guys, basically, you know, the spooky thing is that it's all DNA. That all known life in the universe has as its organizing code DNA, that there's this single language through which information is being passed over time through all of these different forms of organization, through bugs and people and microbes and cities and companies. And at the end of the day, that DNA is doing something. There's information being produced, or at least there's information being transferred from one form to another. And we're a part of that. In some sense, we're being used by whatever that force is, not necessarily in a volitional way, but it's happening and we're caught up in it and we can't escape it. And that is a sort of mystical story that is absolutely rooted in known observations, and it's really freaky.
Okay, so
I don't need more than that. In other words, that is weird enough for me.
But so if you look at the, like, let's, you're probably big on statistics and numbers, right? Am I right there?
Sure.
Okay, so if you look like at the numbers, right? For me, this is the part that makes me feel like there's something to all this. And maybe, I'm sure, maybe we can never answer the question why. But as a journalist, my job is to ask why, and I kind of get a little obsessive with it. And I'm sure it's not just journalists that ask this question, by the way. But when you look at like the numbers, so for example, the Earth spins at 1,036 miles per hour, right?
That's because of thetans.
What's that?
That's because of thetans.
What do you mean?
Well, let's talk about it later.
Okay, we'll talk about it later. But if you slowed the Earth down, you might just float off. Or if you sped it up, you would not be able to get up from this chair forever. And if you look at the numbers, that's just one number, for example. If you look at all the you know, black matter they're finding in the universe now, right? That they that and the and this statistics of, like, if you look at the numbers, that if it didn't exist, the universe would collapse in on itself. And if there were more of it, it would just expand too quickly and we wouldn't be here. All of these things, like, for example, there are a billion galaxies in the universe and each galaxy has a billion stars. And the chance of like us being here amid that, it all worked out. And to think about the reality that, like, oh, it just happened by chance and we're just here floating on a little blue dot, to me just seems ludicrous. It seems like...
Well, I mean, I just don't know where else you would find any explanation. I mean, let's say it did happen entirely randomly.
Yeah.
As a consequence of a very weird history. Then whoever those fortunate organisms were who could talk about it and do podcasts and all this would imaginably be asking themselves, why us? How did we get here? Why did I win the lottery? Or why did I, you know, get cursed, depending on how you're feeling that day? And I don't know that they would have any satisfying answer. I mean, if we had a God's eye view and we watched the whole thing go down, if we watched that whole history unfold and there were just these group of people there, you know, it would almost be funny for us to hear them saying, why are we here? And, you know, the answer would just be, well, that's what happened.
I guess the part of the reason that I
mean, why do you have two kids? I don't know. Like, it happened. You can explain what happened before that. But in some sense, I said to a friend once, you know, why did something happen? Well, the explanation is literally everything that happened before.
Yeah, that's what someone I interviewed said once, too.
Who's that guy? I should meet this person.
I'm now forgetting his name. He was a big TV guy. I will remember it by the end of this podcast. Norman Lear. Norman Lear said, I'd asked, he was talking about the war and being in World War II and in a fighter jet and shooting his gun and how angry he felt at the Nazis and this, that, and the other. And I said to him, like, after killing all those people, do you, like, think about, you know, does it make you think about why we're here, whatever? And he looked at me and said, every single thing that happened in the universe to this date is brought you and me together sitting across from each other right now. That's why we're here. Which is a good answer. But I guess the reason that I always come back to it, it's because I think about the bad things that happen and the people that are bad and do bad things. And that, like, for example, I've done a little reporting on the NRA recently, right? And the guy who, one of the guys who came up with a lot of the advertising campaigns, the, you know, we are the NRA and, like, a lot of the really, the slogans and whatnot, he recently died of a heart attack. His last name was McQueen, Agnes McQueen. Not a good guy. You know, profited heavily off of a lot of bad things that he did. And he died peacefully from a heart attack. And I look at that and I think to myself, like, there was no justice there. Like, why did that happen? And I think that, and I just wonder, like, is there a reason or no? And that's what makes me ask that question all the time.
Well, I guess I would turn it back on you and say, you know, even... hypothetically, what could a satisfying explanation look like? What form could it take that would lead you to go, okay, I'm happy, satisfied? That's what I've always been wanting someone to tell me.
I think my puny little brain is not capable of coming up with one. I would love for someone to tell me and explain it to me. But I think that, you know, it's interesting. I read... after a few podcasts ago, Krista, my wife, gave me some of C.S. Lewis's books on Christianity and so on and so forth. And he talks about how in his theory, and I didn't agree with everything, but very clever in the way he thought about things. He said, you know, we as humans arrive here, this is going back to God now, but we arrive here and we feel thirst. That is because our bodies want water. Right, we feel hunger because our bodies want to be fed. We feel a yearning to connect because we need that. It's like we don't come with instructions. We absolutely come with instructions, right? We cry so that we can communicate and so on. And he said we question if God exists because God does exist. And I thought that that was, it was kind of an interesting way of looking at it, is that we are designed to question this thing. The question is, are we designed to find an answer?
Well, that's a good question, which we will not answer.
Which we will not answer, although I will say a couple of weeks ago.
You came close?
No, I didn't come close, but a guest did, Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Yeah,
what did he was say? On. He was pretty smart and pretty brilliant. I mean, he's a very smart guy.
Yeah.
He said that if you, and I've heard this before, but he articulated it in such a simple way that I understood it. He said that, you know, when you look at what the stars are made of, and you look at what we're made of, and what everything is made of, we're all made of the same stuff. And so because we are questioning our existence in the universe, because we are made of what the universe is made of, we are the universe questioning why it's here.
Sure.
Which I thought
I mean, that's tautological.
And then I read another book right afterwards about consciousness.
Yeah.
And about how there's a theory, which I'm sure you know about, that every single thing on...
It's like the phi...
Yeah, everything has consciousness, like from a dog to a human to a rock, and that we think we're the only ones with it, but really the rock has some form of consciousness, and there's like scientific evidence to prove that that's possible, and then that sent me down a whole nother
path.
Well,
I look at a lot of this through the lens of information theory, and the idea that the sort of most fundamental stuff that we're aware of. Actually, let me put it differently. There's the stuff in the universe, and then there's the relationships between that stuff. And what I've been thinking lately is that all the most interesting things are the invisible things. It's the relationships between people that are interesting. In, you know, we were talking about capitalism. What is capitalism? Well, it's just a set of behaviors that a bunch of people are collectively engaging in. You can't hold on to capitalism. It only exists when performed by a huge group of people, or even a small group of people. And information is a way of conceptualizing the relationships between things, between matter in the universe, and then the ability for that set of relationships to mutate and transmutate into other forms of the same thing. And, you know, if you go and you read the Claude Shannon paper that sort of jump-started information theory and all of computing, the amazing thing that he talks about is how do you take essentially an idea and then turn that into electrons, and then the same idea comes out the other side. You know, how do you go from what, you know, how do I have an idea, turn it into words which flutter the air in between you and me, which reverberate this cone in your ear, these little hair cells in your ear, and then tingle your neurons, and you come out with something that's kind of similar to what was in my head. There's this constant exchange of information that is agnostic to the substrate. It's agnostic to the material that is its vehicle. And all of that information is invisible. And so to me, and the same with DNA. DNA is just a way of encoding information, just like ones and zeros. The magic's not in the A, C, T, and G, or the one and the zero. It's in the way they're put together. You know, the music's not in the fact that this piano has a bunch of keys that can make different frequencies. It's in the order of the notes and how quickly you play them and which ones you play at the same time. And so all of the most interesting, exciting, beautiful things that I'm aware of in the universe are these invisible things that have to do with structure of information, irrespective of what form it takes. And, you know, that set of ideas, that sum total of information that's been percolating through all of these different media from the beginning of the universe is the closest thing to a God that I can imagine. It's invisible, it's in everything, and it can take multiple different forms. And the cool thing is that we have some agency over where some of it goes. And you know, that small sliver of power that we have in our clutch is kind of the only thing worth talking about, because it's the only thing we can do. And the only thing we can actually work with. All the other information that's being passed around the universe, you know, without more expansive technologies, we have no control over. And this ability, to Bill Nye's point, for the information that we create and manipulate through conscious interaction, reflection, introspection, communication, and then actuate on the rest of the world, is our footprint in the universe. And having some agency, again, over where those footprints are placed and what they look like, you know, is to me the important question.
Interesting. All right. Well, listen. No, it's true. It's
Is that satisfying?
It's satisfying to me. I think that
that's pretty weird, right?
It's all weird. The thing that I've always found so the best part of all this is that people who are religious believe in something that can never be proven, right?
Right.
They believe in an idea that no matter what you do, you will never be able to prove that it exists, really. You can say there's miracles and, like, you know, things like that. But the reality is, unless you can repeat the miracle, like, it is not a – that's an anomaly, not a statistic, right? And science – people in science look at the people who are religious and say, oh, well, you can't prove it. Science is going to prove it, that it doesn't exist, or that religion doesn't exist, and that we're just these kind of things blobbing around on a little blue planet in the middle of nowhere. And if when you get to the to quantum mechanics and you get to the many world theories around the fact that there's a multiverse where there's a billion different versions of this universe itself, not just the Milky Way, but like literally the universe, there are billions of different versions of that. Even when science proves that that is real, there is it is impossible. It's possible that we will be able to one day travel to the stars and to other planets and this, that, and the other. It is impossible that we will ever be able to get to another universe. And so therefore, when science answers all the questions in this universe, the one question it won't be able to answer, we will just have to trust that it's real. So in the same respect, scientists will be forced to believe in something that there's no way to prove it is real, in the same way that people who are religious do today.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the world's religions, their value is much more in giving us ideas about how to live,
yep,
practically, day to day, than it is about answering questions that ultimately are completely irrelevant to how each of us chooses to live on a daily basis. And I acknowledge that there are these set of questions that are essentially unanswerable. And you can go to religion to find an answer to them, or you can go to science and it won't give you an answer to them. But I just don't crave those answers that much, because they're genuinely irrelevant to all of the hard stuff I've got to deal with.
Like which dining chairs to get.
I mean, you know, and my conclusion is that God was in Pierre Paulin's studio in 1962 when he designed the Ligne Rosette TV chair, as it's called, the one we chose. Yeah. Very comfortable. You've sat in it.
Yeah.
Very comfortable.
Very comfortable chair. DA, this has been fantastic. Any last words?
Well, I think what you said before we pressed record was that what people want with this podcast is to have essentially been placed in the middle seat on an airplane between two friends who are having a really weird conversation. And I think we've delivered.
I think we've delivered, although I don't think anyone's still listening.
I think that's probably true. But if they are,
they're
probably going to stalk you.
DA, this has been amazing. Thanks for coming. Thanks for taking over the podcast. I'm going to make you read the thank you now.
Okay.
All right, DA, hit it.
Well, D.A. Wallach here, and I want to thank my guest, Nick Bilton. I'm going to end this with my best radio voice, Nick. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there.
You've got a really
great
radio voice.
Thanks to the folks, thank you, at Cadence 13 for their production work. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors, Lightstream, Fiverr, and BetterHelp. Please support them the way they support this podcast. I'll see you next week.
I feel like whoever is still listening, it's like the one person in the theater that's waiting to see if their name shows up.
Well, hi, Todd.
Hi, Todd.
Todd, this one's for you.
See you next week, Todd.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of The Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read The Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.